The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The shutdown and what's for dinner today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. Food has to be inspected for safety no matter where it comes from. USDA inspectors are still on the job despite the shutdown, but some of what they do is on hold, like unannounced inspections designed to prevent disease outbreaks.
That work is on hold. Depending on how long the shutdown lasts, that could mean hundreds or even thousands of facilities that make food that are not being inspected.
And a former Mexican diplomat looks ahead at President Trump's planned border visit later this week.
One would assume that he's going for the simple reason of inflaming the rhetoric, which is what he likes to do when he goes places.
Plus, a small U.S. company takes a gamble on Venezuelan oil. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're into week three of the government shutdown now. No question this is a big problem for the hundreds of thousands of federal workers who are not getting paid. But what if you're not a furloughed federal worker? How's this going to impact you? Well, here's a thought. Is your food safe? Among the many government agencies that are still shut down are the Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration. Food safety is one of their top priorities. The World's Jason Margolis has been looking into what the shutdown means for safety and food imports.
Here's the good news. Food inspectors are still on the job. Here's the bad.
I'd say you should be very worried about your food safety, in part because the work that's not being done right now is the work that's needed to prevent the next outbreak of foodborne illness.
Sarah Sorcher is with the Center for Science and the Public Interest, a consumer health and food watchdog in Washington. Just to allay your worst fears, FDA inspectors are still out there responding to foodborne disease outbreaks and recalls, and USDA inspectors are still overseeing the slaughter of animals for food consumption. So what's not happening?
They're not going in and doing routine, unannounced inspections that are designed to catch insanitary conditions and other problems before they make people sick. That work is on hold. Depending on how long the shutdown lasts, that could mean hundreds or even thousands of facilities that make food that are not being inspected. They're doing some work to monitor imports, but some of that work is not being done.
But just how risky is our food supply, domestic and imported? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 48 million people in the U.S. get sick each year from foodborne illnesses. 3,000 die, mostly the very young and old. Illnesses associated with imported foods have increased in recent years, but so has the amount of food we import. Today, we import close to 20% of what we eat. Now, it's really hard to trace the source of what makes us sick. Think about it. When we get food poisoning, we play amateur epidemiologist and start racking our brains for everything we ate the day before. Sarah Sorcher says we can't definitively say if imported food is causing more health-related outbreaks in the U.S., but she can say this.
The regulations we have in place and the oversight we have over our food supply in the United States is probably a lot stronger than the oversight that our agencies have over food that's coming in to the system. So depending on which country that food is coming from, they may not have a lot of strong food safety controls in place in that country, and that should raise concern for consumers.
Sorcher says we blew an opportunity to improve food safety controls with Canada and Mexico when the Trump administration recently renegotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement. Revising or getting out of NAFTA was one of President Trump's key campaign promises. Under the rules of NAFTA, defined back in the 1990s, food safety systems in Mexico and Canada needed to be equivalent to the U.S. Essentially, we put our faith in their inspectors.
Well, equivalency means close enough.
I went for a drive in South Dakota with Bill Bullard, the CEO of RCAF, an organization of American cattle ranchers. He says before NAFTA, imported food from Mexico and Canada had to be subjected to stricter standards.
But they found that that was an impediment to trade because Canada and Mexico and other countries could not meet the higher standards in the United States.
Bullard is lobbying for the U.S. to impose more stringent requirements under a revised trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, but that hasn't happened.
We believe the United States cattle producer produces beef under the most stringent health and safety standards. We produce the best beef in the world under the best of conditions.
Of course, Canada and Mexico takes issue with that, and free trade advocates say U.S. farmers have long exaggerated the threat of foodborne illnesses to restrict import competition. The major Canadian and Mexican beef associations, along with another U.S. beef group, urged President Trump not to mess with NAFTA and jeopardize its success. Lori Wallach with the group Public Citizen says that success has benefited large agribusiness, multinational vegetable processing and meatpacking companies.
They've got this whole sort of North American system where they have figured out where the cow poop disposal is the cheapest. Mexico, you can just throw it into a river. Where the worker salaries are the lowest, Mexico, it's where they do a lot of the slaughtering now. And it's this whole sort of big beef system that has screwed the ranchers.
But with more free trade, we do benefit overall. We can get fresh fruits and vegetables year-round, generally at lower prices than if there were more trade barriers. But back to food safety. Sarah Sorcher says if 3,000 people are dying from foodborne illnesses here each year, it's pretty clear we need more controls.
We did have an opportunity with NAFTA to improve our food safety controls, and we didn't.
When the U.S., Canada, and Mexico came to a new understanding on trade in October, President Trump spoke from the White House Rose Garden for more than an hour touting a revised NAFTA. He didn't say the word food or safety a single time. The new trade agreement still needs legislative approval from all three nations. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
We can expect to hear more from President Trump directly and soon. Trump is planning a primetime address on Tuesday evening to talk about the government shutdown. And the White House says the president will head to the U.S.-Mexico border on Thursday, where he'll continue to press his case for a border wall. The president says this is a crisis. He's even threatened to declare a national emergency if that's what it's going to take to get his wall built. But when some people look at what's happening at the border, they don't see a crisis at all.
He's pretending to be tough in a situation in which there is no need to be tough. These are children. These are women. I mean, these are not terrorists as they are portrayed.
That's Jorge Guajardo. He spent nearly a decade serving as a Mexican diplomat.
President Trump campaigned on a wall, and now it seems as if he's on a straitjacket trying to create a crisis to justify his wall. There is no crisis.
But there is tension at the border. I mean, the U.S. has used tear gas twice in recent weeks. There is a logjam at the border. Doesn't that constitute a crisis?
No. And I will tell you why not. Yes, the fact that the U.S. is firing tear gas at the border is awful. It's terrible. But then again, it's not the first time the Trump administration does awful things. If we say that everything is a crisis that they do, well, I think we would be oversimplifying things. They implemented a travel ban. Was there a crisis? No, there wasn't. But that's the way they reacted. They like to do high-impact things, and they like to pretend they're coming in strong, and firing tear gas is one of those cases. So there is no need for these actions. There is no crisis.
Mexico has a new president. Andrés Manuel López Obrador was sworn in just last month. How has his government responded to this debate about the border so far? I mean, the whole U.S. controversy and debate about the border. Is he taking a meek approach or a bold approach?
Keep in mind that unlike our previous president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador did campaign on a promise of facing President Trump and being tough with President Trump. And he has certainly not done so. I'm not necessarily saying that that's a bad thing. We do have to work with the United States. We are partners in many areas. But there is not much leeway for President López Obrador to be meek with Trump. So Press Secretary Sanders just announced that President Trump will be going to the border on Thursday. One would assume that he's going for the simple reason of inflaming the rhetoric, which is what he likes to do when he goes places. And this puts President López Obrador in a very difficult position because he has to respond in a way that he's not seen as being weak. And I'm not sure that's what he wants to do at this point.
What do you think he should do?
He did say on campaign that he was not going to be doing the U.S.'s dirty work, that he was not going to be the one stopping Central American immigrants coming to the United States for the simple reason that we have always had a policy that we will not do to our southern neighbors what we accuse our northern neighbors of doing to us. So the fact that he's now cooperating with the Trump administration in saying that Mexico will be sort of a buffer, I think puts him in a tenuous position. I think he should be more upfront with President Trump.
For example?
Let's see what President Trump goes and says on Thursday. And I will also say that President Trump has sort of devalued his word, his bully pulpit. People no longer pay as much attention when he is issuing attacks. But if he is firing tear gas, I think Mexico should take this to the multilateral bodies, to the UN, to the OAS, and just start raising these issues. I mean, there is no reason for the U.S. to be firing anything across the border to Mexico.
The U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, she announced last month that thousands of asylum seekers would be returned to Mexico while their cases are considered. It's been a few weeks now, and it seems unclear if that plan is going forward. Is Mexico going along with that idea?
You can't just drop these people in Mexico as if they were garbage that you sort of throw over the fence to your neighbor's house. I mean, these people have nationalities. They have countries that have to answer for them. And if they are caught in the United States, just as if you caught a Kuwaiti or any other nationality, you can't just send them back to Mexico, assuming, well, you know, that's what's easiest for us. Regardless of where they're coming in from, they have to be sent to their countries, not to the neighboring countries, just as they can't be sent to Canada.
But has it been discussed in the Mexican media or among government officials? Like, hey, she announced this. What are we going to do about it?
You know, not much. The thing about Mexico is not as obsessed with President Trump as the U.S. assumes that Mexico is obsessed with President Trump. So even though it gets a little play, most Mexicans don't know this.
What are you looking for on Thursday when President Trump goes to the border?
Well, I think he's going to have one of his, you know, what he likes to meet with border agents who he will cherry pick to be favorable to his cause. I assume he will pick the ones that don't mind that they're not being paid. I guess there are fewer of those. And he will try to say that there's a crisis. And I mean, yeah, I remember as a candidate, when he went to Laredo, he said how his wife was concerned for his safety as he flew there. And he asked his pilots to make sure they didn't overfly the Mexican territory because it was so dangerous. So that's what he likes to do. I mean, he likes to portray this as a big crisis and he's a hero coming in and addressing this problem. There is no crisis. He's addressing nothing. He's stoking the flames. He's inflaming the rhetoric. That's what he's going to do on Thursday.
Jorge Guajardo spent nearly a decade in Mexico's diplomatic corps before leaving in 2013. He was appointed by presidents from Mexico's conservative National Action Party. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Diplomacy, as they say, is an art. Pianist, composer, and band leader Arturo O'Farrell knows that very well.
Ni vimos a vender, ni vimos a comprar.
That's O'Farrell welcoming the audience at a concert in Tijuana. We're not here to sell you anything, he begins. We're here to say thank you to you, the people of Tijuana and Mexico, for inspiring us.
¡Que viva México!
Arturo O'Farrell and his Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra performed a series of concerts along the border between Tijuana and San Diego last year. Sharing the bill were musicians from all over the globe, including the French-Chilean rapper Ana Tijoux. We'll let Ana and her song Somos Sur, or We Are South, take us to the break.
Nigeria, Bolivia, Chile, Angola, Puerto Rico y Tunisia, Argelia, Venezuela, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Mozambique, Costa Rica, Camerún, Congo, Cuba, Somalia, México, República Dominica, Tanzania, fuera, Yankee de América Latina, franceses, ingleses y holandeses, yo te quiero libre, Palestina.
Ana Tijoux performing Somos Sur along the U.S.-Mexico border. This is The World.
This podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to our podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics with far-reaching implications, from how venture capital is fueling innovation, to the global shift toward renewable energy, to the economic impacts of President Trump's legislative agenda, and more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Venezuela is oil rich. The country is home to the world's biggest oil reserves, but the Venezuelan economy is in shambles, and the oil business has suffered too. Big names in the oil drilling industry have stayed away. That's left Venezuela to look to smaller, more obscure companies to fill the gap, including one U.S. energy firm. It's called Arepla. We're going to hear more about that company from Luke Cohen in a minute. Cohen covers Venezuela's oil industry for Reuters. First, he told us why more established oil companies are avoiding the country.
Venezuela, as you know, is undergoing a severe economic crisis and has a crippling debt load that the government struggles to pay. So that affects oil companies because they're owed hundreds of millions of dollars from Venezuela, and they're not going to invest more and, you know, take on more projects if there's no guarantee that they're getting paid.
And there's also a political side to this, too. Don't sanctions prevent American oil companies from doing business in Venezuela?
Well, the sanctions technically are somewhat limited. They don't explicitly prevent U.S. oil companies from doing business in Venezuela. In fact, some large companies such as Chevron have maintained their operations. The sanctions do prevent U.S. companies and businesses from lending money to Venezuela. And so I think the reach of sanctions is not 100% clear. And so companies are wary to do anything that might be interpreted as being in violation of sanctions. And it raises the reputational risk of investing in Venezuela for sure.
So along comes this little company, Arepla. What do we know about this? And what are they trying to do in Venezuela?
Right. What we know about Arepla is that it was registered in Delaware in November. So it's a very new company. We know that it is part owned by a man named Harry Sargent, who has a long career in the oil industry. He provided fuel for U.S. troops in Iraq. And he's also served as the finance chairman of the Florida Republican Party. What Arepla is trying to do now in Venezuela, it signed a services agreement with the state-run oil company PDVSA, in which it would basically provide oil field services of the type that, you know, large established companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger are not doing anymore.
Like what?
This could be anything from, you know, actually drilling the wells to providing workers, obtaining the, you know, materials and chemicals that are needed to help pump the oil out of the ground. This isn't the first agreement of the kind that, you know, President Nicolas Maduro's government has signed with a little-known oil company. In fact, in August, they announced 14 similar deals with companies that really no one had ever heard of. You know, most of those companies were Venezuelan. This is the first indication we have that a U.S. company is getting involved in some of these, you know, new business models that Venezuela is turning to as its economy unravels.
Do we know that this new very little company, Arepla, do we know that it has the experience to do what Venezuela needs done?
We don't. In fact, you know, Harry Sargent, one of their owners, who has experience in refining and shipping, does not appear to have experience in the actual pumping of oil out of the ground, which, you know, is very technically demanding. And Venezuela's fields, you know, provide their own set of complications. A spokesman for the company has told me that there is another owner of Arepla that does have experience extracting oil from the ground in similar conditions to, you know, Venezuela's geological characteristics, but they haven't elaborated on who that company is or exactly what kind of experience they have.
You mentioned the difficulty of extracting oil in Venezuela is just simply the geology of it. Doesn't that difficulty in extracting make it kind of tough for this little upstart company?
Right. One thing to remember about Venezuela's oil is that it's very heavy, which means that in order to make it into anything useful, you need to mix it with, you know, a number of other products that, you know, largely need to be imported into Venezuela. And so that is, you know, another complication. So I think there is reason to be skeptical that this company has the, you know, experience and expertise needed.
President Nicolas Maduro is starting a new term this week. How desperate is he to get more barrels per day out there and really sort of facilitate the oil industry that's been kind of languishing?
Certainly. Very desperate. I mean, I think what's important to remember here is that there's a direct relationship between how much oil Venezuela produces and how much food that Venezuelans are able to put on their tables. So, you know, the oil makes up over 90% of Venezuela's exports. That's a significant portion of government revenue, which it needs to import food and medicine, which is, you know, a major factor in the humanitarian crisis that we're seeing today in Venezuela.
Luke Cohen covers Venezuela for Reuters. Thanks a lot, Luke.
Oh, thank you very much.
A scrapyard in the Netherlands is inviting people to vent their frustration on their old cars. The scrapyard is in Amsterdam, and it claims this is a therapeutic activity. But as you hear in a minute, some mental health professionals have concerns. Here's the BBC's Anna Holligan with the story.
We're dodging shards of glass as a sledgehammer slams into the windscreen of a bottle-green Volkswagen. It's being wielded by a man wearing an orange jumpsuit on a scrapyard near Amsterdam.
I love working with cars. Never really tore one apart like this. So.
Car smash is promoted as the ultimate tool in anger management. Its creator, Merlijn Boshuizen, aspires to take the concept of rage rooms and destruction therapy to the next level.
I do believe car smash is a great way to have some anger released, you know, instead of doing it on the streets or in a way where it's illegal, you know. You can do it in our scrapyard in a legal way, you know. A lot of people come over just to have a bit of fun, you know, they're on a bachelor party or just friends looking to have a fun afternoon together. But yeah, we also have, you know, people who actually come to us because they have experienced something bad in their lives.
It really feels good. It really feels good, yeah.
It's harder than I expected, but it's more satisfying than I expected, so I think that's a good balance.
Well, actually, to be completely honest, it kind of scares me. You know, now it's cars. Next time it can be something else. Joanna Pantazi is a psychologist who runs her own more conventional therapy sessions.
It's different if a group of friends or a work group, for example, does that just one time. But it's still kind of tricky because they might like it and then they might want to go and express their anger in this way. And then you're actually giving yourself the message that this is okay, instead of learning other productive ways, for example, to calm yourself down, to regulate your emotions, to be mindful of what's happening, to take a break, then you're actually breaking things. So, for instance, there are people that say it's better that they do that than go on a football match and then break everything there, or go home and beat up their wives. But I disagree, because it's still enhancing the same response, the response that you can act out on very, very intense emotions.
And if you're ever struggling to control your anger, then the mental health charity Mind recommends contacting your doctor first of all, and also some free self-help options, including exercising and relieving the feeling by tearing up newspaper or smashing ice cubes in a sink.
The BBC's Anna Holligan venting her frustrations on an ice cube. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. A young Saudi woman flees from her country and her family and lands in Thailand, which could be a problem.
If you're a dissident and you're running away from your country, Thailand tends to want to send you back.
But the good news for her? She gets to stay, for now. The latest from Thailand ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. For more than 24 hours, people from across the globe watched her ordeal play out on social media. I'm talking about Rahaf Mohammed Al-Kunun. She's the 18-year-old woman from Saudi Arabia who started tweeting from the Bangkok airport on Saturday. She'd been on vacation with her family in Kuwait. She said she slipped away from them and caught a flight to Thailand. I'm in real danger because the Saudi embassy is trying to force me to go back to Saudi Arabia, she wrote on Twitter. On Sunday, my BBC colleague James Kumarsamy spoke to Rahaf Muhammad Al-Kunun in Bangkok, and he asked her why she wanted to flee Saudi Arabia.
I don't have rights in Saudi Arabia, and my family treat me so bad. They will kill me.
Why do you think that?
Because I shared my story and my pictures in social media, and my father is so angry because I did this.
What exactly did you share? What is your story?
My story that I ran away and my country took my passport.
And why did you decide to renounce Islam?
Because women don't have rights in Islam.
Because women don't have rights in Islam, she says. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But first, we go to the world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, who's been following the story.
It's been this blow-by-blow drama on Twitter, which has ended with her being in the hands of UN refugee agency officials. So that is actually an outcome that bodes well for her, at least in the short term. It doesn't look like she's going to be sent back to Saudi Arabia in the near term.
So does that mean she's no longer barricaded in the hotel room?
Right, exactly. So most of this drama has played out from her hotel room. We've been seeing inside her hotel room via her smartphone for hours and hours and hours, and it's been very dramatic. You know, you see her barricading the door. She posts these videos of officials knocking on the door and trying to call, and her, you know, in a very frustrated way answering back, "I only will speak to the UN." So that drama has ended, and I think that now I suspect the advice she'll get from UN officials is stop tweeting. However, the tweeting, you can make a case that it saved her life. I mean, if we take her at face value and we assume that if she goes back to Saudi Arabia, she could be killed, and apostates are killed in Saudi Arabia, then the tweeting she did, turning her private struggle into this huge media sensation, that may have really saved her life.
Let's go back to how this all started. Rahaf Muhammad Al-Kunun flew to Thailand from Kuwait, where she'd been on holiday with her family. She was then reportedly en route to Australia, but she was intercepted in Thailand. What happened then?
Well, it appears that maybe she didn't have a plane ticket to go to Australia. At least that's what the Thai immigration officials are saying, if we take them at their word. They saw her, and then the Saudi government intervened, figured out where she was, and this started this whole family drama. Now, on the Thai official side, they've been saying different things. I mean, at one point they were saying, an official was saying, well, she's not a refugee, she's a child, and we have to turn her back over to her family. The immigration chief said, well, she came without a guardian, and if we allow her to enter, she'll be unsafe. You know, she's an 18-year-old woman. 18-year-old women come to Thailand for holiday all the time, and no one gives them any grief. So that tone has changed now, and now the immigration chief is saying, we're not going to send her back if she'll be killed. We just wouldn't do that.
And that was a Thai official who said that she's not accompanied by a man, which is, of course, echoing a Saudi policy of kind of male guardianship.
Well, yes, and I can explain what's going on here. Thailand doesn't like to rock the boat. Thai officials don't like to jump out and, you know, make a big crusade for human rights if it's going to affect relations with another country. However, if there's a massive media frenzy, and this young woman has done a great job of creating one, then they have to reconsider, you know, what's worse, diplomatic fallout or, you know, public scorn.
It's interesting because this case is very reminiscent of the recent case involving the Bahraini refugee soccer player, Hakim Al-Araibi, who was detained in Bangkok recently.
Yeah, and he's still detained. His fate is unclear. Thailand isn't the type of place, again, that's going to wave the flag for your dissident rights.
Now, she's been given a temporary permit by Thai authorities. What are her options at the moment?
That temporary permit, we don't know exactly what that means. Her options are to apply for asylum in a third country, and the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, has said that they will help facilitate that request. They have also said they feel pretty safe that the Thais are not going to send her back to Saudi Arabia, that they feel comfortable with those assurances.
The world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you, Carol.
Rahaf Mohammed Al-Kunun isn't the first woman to get out of Saudi Arabia seeking safety. Over the last few years, hundreds of young women have fled the kingdom. As we heard earlier, the consequences for fleeing and for renouncing Islam can be severe. Hanan Razik reports for the BBC's Arabic service. She says Al-Kunun's fear of returning to Saudi Arabia is real.
She could well face death sentence, Carol, because renouncing Islam or converting from Islam is not legal in the conservative kingdom. She could be sent to court, and in this case, this punishment is very viable. However, there hasn't been any this punishments in the recent years, but there is definitely that risk.
So you're not able to renounce Islam. That's a crime.
You're not able to renounce Islam. That's definitely a crime in Saudi Arabia.
How often do Saudi women flee their families and go abroad?
In the last few years, there has been reports of hundreds of Saudi young women, specifically between the ages of 17 and 24, trying to flee their families over claims of either domestic abuse or being forced to marry or seeking a different lifestyle. Some of them managed to get asylum in places like Australia or some places, some countries in the West, like the US, for example. Some others couldn't, like the case of Dina Ali, the 24-year-old who back in 2017, tried to flee Saudi Arabia and seek asylum in Australia. On her way, she was stopped in the Philippines and sent back to Saudi Arabia. And nobody has heard of what happened to her ever since.
So we have no idea what happened to her or any other Saudi women who try to flee and are forced to go back.
We have no idea of what happened to her. We know of stories of Saudi young women being sent back to Saudi Arabia under the custody, if you may say, of their families. Because, you know, in Saudi Arabia, there is a male guardianship system. So for a Saudi woman to be able to issue a passport or travel abroad or marry, she has to get the consent of her male guardian. And that would be either her father, her brother, her husband, or sometimes her son.
Do we know anything about Rahaf Mohammed Al-Kunun's family or her father's status in Saudi Arabia?
So we know from local media reports in Saudi and in the Gulf region that her father actually works for the government. He's an official for the local authorities in one of the Saudi cities. Her family lives between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. We have been trying to reach out to the family, but they refused to comment. But we now know that her father is in Thailand and he is in touch with the Saudi authorities. So we don't know how this story will unfold yet.
I know Twitter's pretty popular in Saudi Arabia. What are you seeing Saudis in terms of how they're responding to this online?
You're absolutely right, Carol. Twitter is very popular in Saudi Arabia. And also we have to bear in mind that it's quite a young country. So over half the population are under the age of 35. So they are very heavy on using social media and on using Twitter. Their action to Rahaf's story, and I can see from my timeline and my news feed, has been varying between a lot of support, praising her action, calling her such a brave and courageous woman. At the same time, there have been other reactions asking so many questions about why she had to transit in Thailand, why she didn't go to Australia directly, why now? Because this is also coming in the light of recent events, and a lot of pressure is being put on Saudi Arabia on the world stage after the death of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And some on Twitter have been translating this into a campaign against Saudi Arabia in general, and having the world eyes on the conservative kingdom right now is not making a lot of people very happy there.
Hanan Razik is the BBC's Arabic reporter. Hanan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
Our next story also has to do with young women trying to resist pressure from their families. In this case, we're talking about British girls and women whose immigrant parents decide to send them back to the family's home country to be forced into marriage. Sometimes they escape, and with the help of the British government, they're repatriated back to the UK. But for many of those girls and young women, there's an added burden. The cost of the repatriation is considered a loan, which the British government expects them to pay back. Pragna Patel is the founder of a group in Britain that helps girls get out of forced marriages. It's called Southall Black Sisters. My colleague Marco Werman recently spoke with Patel about some of the challenges these women and girls face.
In this particular case, we were supporting five girls who originated from Somaliland, whose parents had sent them back to Somaliland to attend a so-called correctional school. Parents were clearly concerned about these girls becoming too westernized in their eyes. Now, at the school, there were girls from many other parts of the world, including US. These girls were subject to a very brutal regime of cruelty, violence, sexual assault, torture. And one of the girls managed to escape and raise the alarm. Fortunately for all the girls, the local police raided the school and the girls were all freed and sent back to their respective embassies to be repatriated to their respective countries.
Right. So these girls, are they UK residents and citizens?
Yes, of course. They were British girls and their parents had sent them to this correctional school where they were left to fend for themselves effectively in what was a very horrific regime. And some were being forced into marriage. Others were expected to have a marriage.
So then they're at their respective embassies. The UK Foreign Office helps organize these repatriation flights and then charges them? Explain that.
Well, that's the bizarre aspect of all of this. The UK is, of course, to be commended insofar as it does have a repatriation program in relation to forced marriage. But if a young woman or girl, and usually they are females, are taken abroad for the purposes of marriage, and if they manage to get a message to their, you know, consular services, the British consular services or the embassy, then following some preliminary investigation, the embassy or consular services will rescue them. So all well and good up to that point. The point at which it takes a slightly unusual and strange turn is at the point at which the girls are rescued and then brought back to the embassy. At that stage, they're made to sign an agreement, which is a legal agreement, binding, which states that they will, in return for their flights, home and accommodation and food, will agree to paying back the loan and that they will pay that loan back within 6 months.
Did most of the girls understand what they were signing?
Well, that's the thing. If you can imagine these Somali girls who were subject to incredibly cruel and horrific torture, if you can imagine their desperation, their despair, their fear, and finally being rescued, and then at that point being passed a piece of paper and asked to sign, I suspect that all of them sign in that desperation without knowing what they're signing and without understanding the legal consequences of what they're signing.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, where are these women now? Because their families in the UK wanted to marry them off. They can't go back to the families.
No,
they certainly
not.
Can't turn to their families for financial help to pay these loans.
Absolutely. They can't. They don't have any financial help to repay the loans. They're desperately trying to face their futures, to rebuild their lives. Some of these women have been put up in women's shelters by us. Others have not been able to get into women's shelters or in bed and breakfast, but they remain hugely vulnerable. They are very young women who've never lived alone on their own, who don't know how to manage their lives, their finances. And one of the things that all of these young women feel when they come to us is overwhelmed by the debt that hangs around them like a hanged noose. That is the thing that's uppermost in their mind. How are they going to pay back, you know, £700, £800 upwards when they have no money and when their passports are confiscated until they repay their loans, which means that they cannot access services, show proof of identity in order to claim benefits. And it makes it very difficult for them to try and resettle and rebuild their lives.
Pragna Patel is with the charity South All Black Sisters. It helps girls who've been sent abroad from the UK into a forced marriage. She was speaking with the World's Marco Werman. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's a familiar refrain by now. President Trump says one thing and administration officials say another. The latest gray area is U.S. policy in Syria. The president said he wanted American troops to come home immediately. But top U.S. officials have signaled they aren't fully on board with that plan. National Security Advisor John Bolton is visiting Israel and Turkey this week, while Secretary of State Mike Pompeo plans to visit several Arab countries. Aaron David Miller is a former State Department advisor on Middle East affairs. He's with the Wilson Center in Washington. I asked him what Bolton and Pompeo are trying to accomplish.
Largely damage control, largely reassurance, and always in the Trump administration, keeping on the front burner their concern that Iran presents the most credible and critical threat to American interests and regional stability. I find it remarkable also that John Bolton is going to do serious diplomacy, visiting two non-Arab countries, Israel and Turkey, which at the moment are quite consequential. Mike Pompeo is off to reassure the Arab world on a mega trip through most every Arab country with which the United States deals. I think very much this is a John Bolton initiative to toughen up the president's inclinations and sensibilities to try to get out of Syria quickly. And Bolton and Pompeo basically disagree with that position.
You mentioned the fear of Iran, but it seems like President Trump isn't as concerned with Iran.
I think it's a really good point. You have a highly risk-averse president. It's stunning, frankly, that in almost 2 years, given the brazen, bold nature of the rhetoric with respect to Iran, the withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the imposition of sanctions, that American policy has not also been accompanied by a serious effort to block, stop, and constrain Iran's activities in the region. And there's been no direct military confrontation, not the slightest indication that the Americans are prepared to confront Iran and Syria militarily. So I think you have a highly risk-averse U.S. president, much like his predecessor, I might add, and not just in Syria. And you have advisors, particularly Mr. Bolton, who I think is much more concerned about Iran and much more determined somehow to contain or at least roll back some of Iran's gains in the region.
Now, John Bolton says there actually are conditions to U.S. troops withdrawing from Syria. He says ISIS needs to be defeated and Turkey needs to agree not to attack the Kurds. Does this provide any reassurance to our Kurdish allies?
Frankly, if you were Kurdish leaders, whether you were directly involved in the fighting, as the Syrian Democratic Forces are, or whether you're a member of a more authoritative Kurdish body tied directly to the PKK, I'm not sure I would take American assurances at all. Our track record with respect to encouraging the Kurds and supporting them is hardly an uplifting one. And had the Kurds been paying attention, much like the Israelis, I might add, and listening to Mr. Trump's rhetoric over the course of the last year and his determination somehow to leave Syria, they wouldn't have put a great deal of faith and stock in American assurances. We all but said at least twice in the last month that our relationship with the Kurds was tactical, temporary, and transactional. We have no stake, nor is this administration prepared to support Kurdish ambitions to establish any sort of autonomous region in northeastern Syria. So I think the answer to that is no. If I was a Kurd on the battle line, I'd be very wary.
Are Kurdish forces in Syria looking elsewhere for support now? And what options do they really have?
I think their options are pretty grim. They can make their peace with Mr. Erdogan, which I think is politically unacceptable. They can negotiate with the Assad government, but they're negotiating from a position of weakness. And they have hedged their bets. They have maintained contacts with the regime over the last year and a half. And it may well be that they're going to have to make their peace with Assad once we, in fact, leave or, frankly, face a major confrontation with the Turks. So, no, I think that their status in Syria, unlike their status in Iraq, where they've managed to create a measure of security and a self-governing entity, is a much different proposition. So I think the Kurds are in trouble.
How likely is it that Kurdish forces in Syria could strike a lasting deal with Bashar al-Assad?
Kurds are not a majority in Syria. Assad controls two-thirds of the country. The Kurds will be unable to sustain themselves, certainly as a fighting force, without external support from the United States. The Russians have a stake and have maintained a relationship with the Kurds, but I doubt if the Russians, given their other equities in Syria, particularly in supporting the regime and managing the relationship with Iran, are going to want to encourage Kurdish national aspirations. It's not going to happen in Syria.
Do you have any sense of the real U.S. timetable for withdrawal from Syria?
I don't. Given the president's determination, perhaps by the end of his first term, it's not going to happen in 30 days. It's not going to happen in 3 months. Whether it takes 6 months or 8 months, I think really isn't the point. I suspect that it now will be conditions-based. We ought to try to negotiate conditions, but I'm pretty certain those conditions are not going to be realized. The Turks are not going to give us a guarantee that somehow they won't attack the Kurds in northern Syria. And on the other hand, the notion that we are going to defeat the Islamic State strikes me as straining the bounds of credulity to the breaking point.
Aaron David Miller is the Middle East Program Director at the Wilson Center. He's been talking to us about U.S. policy in Syria. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, a nod to Sandra Oh, one of the hosts of last night's Golden Globe ceremony, along with Andy Sandberg. In addition to hosting, Oh made some headlines of her own last night. First, she was quick to celebrate a number of firsts for Asian representation in 2018, particularly the success of Crazy Rich Asians.
It is the first studio film with an Asian American lead since Ghost in the Shell and Aloha.
That's Emma Stone yelling, "I'm sorry," at the end, because, well, both Aloha, which Stone started, and Ghost in the Shell cast white women to play people of Asian descent. Later, Sandra Oh took home her second Golden Globe Award, becoming the first Asian woman to win Best Actress in a drama TV series. Oh played a woman obsessed with an international assassin in the BBC America series Killing Eve. And then she won over the viral hearts of thousands with her acceptance speech.
There are two people here tonight that I am so grateful that they're here with me. I'd like to thank my mother and my father. Oma, Appa, 사랑해요.
Mom, Dad, I love you, she said in Korean. Sandra Oh gets the last word on the show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.